Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Haruska, and I am joined today by Professor Mark Lemley for a discussion on two important but very different topics. The first is a follow-up to my recent conversation with Russ Feingold, wherein we discussed how the federal judiciary is becoming a tale of two systems. Professor Lemley has looked at the data and written about this trend in his recent article for our expert forum entitled Red Courts, Blue Courts, and we're going to delve into that here. The second topic is artificial intelligence and the question of whether AI-generated content is protected by the First Amendment. It's not often that we get a guest who can engage on two such relevant but distinct topics. So before we jump into the conversation, a little bit about my guest. Professor Lemley is the William H. Newcomb Professor of Law at Stanford Law School and the director of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology. He is also a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. Professor Lemley, welcome to Broken Law.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
It is great to have you, especially since Russ and I just discussed your article on episode 132. So it's great to have you so shortly thereafter. But we really wanted to expound on this because the article raises such an important point about the trajectory of the federal judiciary, which is that even though in theory we have this one federal system, we are increasingly seeing a division within the judiciary between what you call red courts and blue courts. Can you just expound on what you mean by that and why it is so problematic?
Sure. Yeah. So the article came out of a just kind of felt sense as I was looking at the Biden judicial nominations and seeing, well, okay, yeah, California, New York, right, Massachusetts, those are all blue states. So I started to do some investigating. And it turns out that in the first sort of term in Congress, President Biden actually appointed as many judges as his predecessors did in their first 2 years, but he overwhelmingly appointed them in blue states. So the numbers for his appointees and nominees in the first term were 84% in blue states, 10% in what I call purple states, and you can kind of argue about what's what, and 6% in red states. And so I wanted to know, well, all right, maybe this is just sort of the way the world happens. But it turns out that's not true. It was somewhat true, although less dramatic in the Trump administration. But you don't have to go back very far to find a very different world. So even in the George W. Bush and Obama administrations, which I think those of us who were there at the time would have felt were hard-fought political, you know, the judiciary has been politicized, we don't see anything of the sort. Both of those presidents are appointing not quite the same, but roughly equal numbers of presidents in red states and blue states. This is a really recent phenomenon, and it has become incredibly dramatic in the Biden administration.
And it's one that we've started to comment on more and more because it's hard to track judicial nominations under the Biden administration and not notice the lack of nominations coming out for vacancies in red states. And it's not because there aren't vacancies. It's just that we're not seeing nominees for them. And that was true in the Trump administration, too. It wasn't that there weren't vacancies in blue states. It's just that's not where the priority was. Is that what your data revealed as well?
Yeah, that's right. So that's right. And you look at the sort of open vacancies, right? The vacancies were pretty reasonably matched, maybe slightly more in blue states for Biden, right? But the result of the appointments has been almost all of the remaining vacancies are actually vacancies in red or in some cases purple states. And they're just not being filled.
Yeah. And you've noted that this has really been stark with the Trump and Biden administrations. And the other trend that this parallels is the partisanship of judicial nominations generally. Russ talks about it often, you know, harking back to his days in the Senate when judicial confirmations were pretty nonchalant bipartisan affair. Maybe Supreme Court confirmations were more contentious, but district court nominations were generally a run-of-the-mill Senate vote, no big deal sort of thing. And now they're becoming really partisan and hard-fought issues on the Senate floor.
Yeah, that's right. And I document that as well, right? So you might think, well, all right, it's a blue state president appointing in blue states, that becomes easier. But in fact, it's become harder. And this too is a function of just the Trump and Biden administrations. So with the exception of Supreme Court justices, and an occasional appellate nomination. Historically, most judges were confirmed unanimously or by lopsided votes. And so again, even in the George W. Bush and Obama presidencies, when we felt like things were very politicized, 94% of Bush's judges were confirmed unanimously or with fewer than 10 votes in opposition. 82% of Obama's judges were confirmed unanimously or within fewer than 10 votes in opposition. That number dropped down to 33% in the Trump administration and to 2% in the Biden administration. 2% of the district court judges appointed by Biden have gotten either unanimous or 90 or more votes. That is a really fundamental change in how we were processing judicial nominations.
Yeah, we like to say that a majority of Biden's judges have received bipartisan support, but the reality is the bipartisan nature is the virtue of two or three senators who consistently cross the aisle. It's not that we're seeing Senate confirmation votes of 80-20. It's that you're seeing 54-55.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one way to think about that is, right, there are, fully a third of the Senate, probably more than a third of the Senate, has never voted in favor of a single Biden judicial nomination, right? So that's clearly not, we're evaluating these people on the merits and finding them lacking. That is an ideological commitment not to approve a judge because we don't like the president who is appointing.
And I will just plug one feature right now in case folks are interested. On our website, you can actually see how every single U.S. senator voted on every single one of Biden's appointed judges so far. So if you're curious how your two U.S. senators have voted, go to the ACS website, go to our data feature, and you can check that out, because it really is stark to see, especially when you look at the color of the state, right? You look at blue state senators, you look at red state senators, the divide is very clear.
One thing I might just note there as well, right? So the other thing that has happened that sort of, I think, contributes a little bit to this process is the number of states with divided senatorial representation has declined dramatically over time, right? I think it's now 5 states, one Democrat and one Republican, or one independent and one party member, right? Almost all the states have just solidly moved in one direction or the other. And I think that makes it more challenging. You know, in a 30 years ago in New York, right, where you had a Republican senator and a Democratic senator, they actually sat down and sort of allocated, okay, the senator, when they're in the minority, will get a quarter of the seats to recommend, and the senator of the majority will get 3/4. They made a deal. And those days seem long gone.
Yeah. And so the question that all of this raises is, why is this happening? And you just hinted at it, which is a term that I think our listeners will recognize, and that's the blue slip. Talk to me about that, because again, this is something that has been around for decades, but didn't result in this sort of divide in the judiciary until very recently.
So that's right. And this is, right, it's one of these norms that I think comes out of the sort of like congeniality of the Senate, right? But the idea that we ought to give some more deference to the views of a home state senator on the appointment of a judge in that state. What's happened, I think, is that the blue slip process has become a way, right, not to object to a particular individual judge who people find objectionable, but to simply block any appointment in that state, right? And, you know, and it does that, I think, both procedurally, right, with the sort of Senate process rules basically make it very hard to sort of overcome this, and the kind of norms become hard to overcome it. But I also think it is compounded by what we saw in 21-22, right? The equal division of the Senate, 50-50, right? And the equal division of the Judiciary Committee as a result meant that you needed at least one Republican vote to get it out of committee. And there were a bunch of judges and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, right, who all ended up with a tie in committee. There's a process by which you can pull something out of the committee despite a tie vote, but it's complicated and it takes time. So, you know, I think one explanation for this is it's just easier, right, in this hyper-partisan environment where you're only counting on one of only a few Republicans to agree to support a candidate, right, to nominate judges in states where the senators are fully behind them and where they aren't going to use blue slips. We see 10 years ago, we changed the blue slip process for appellate judges. We got rid of the process after a similar, although what felt like the same amount of obstructionism, although in retrospect turns out to be much less obstructionism. And so one thing that I find in the paper is that there's still a divide and still a significant divide between red courts and blue courts in the appellate judges, but it is less pronounced than it is with district judges, in part because no individual senator has the power to hold everything up.
And the other aspect of this that we've started to comment on as well is, as you noted, the blue slip can effectively block a nominee, right? A home state senator just has what amounts to a veto for district court nominees for their state. The other part that we're seeing is that when the White House predicts a blue slip problem, they avoid nominating someone altogether. And so you don't even get to the point where the blue slip is obstructing the process because there's no nominee. The White House predicts there's going to be a fight and just basically throws their hands in the air and says it's not worth it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And you know, I mean, that may well be a sort of short-term rational political calculation.
You have a limited amount of time. You want to prioritize those confirmations you think are going to happen.
Right. But I think the ultimate effect of this process, and again, not just sort of Biden and Republicans, right? We saw this to a somewhat lesser extent, but we saw it with Trump and Democrats, right? The ultimate effect of this process, I think, is really corrosive to the judiciary, right? We're already in a position now where, because of the effects of this just among Trump and Biden, right, blue states have mostly blue state judges. Red states have mostly red state judges. That problem's going to get a lot worse as Bush and Obama and Clinton appointees all retire and get replaced or don't get replaced, depending on the ideology of the Senate.
Yeah, and I'll know that there's a representative problem with that, in that what we have seen is Biden has been appointing unprecedentedly diverse candidates. And so what you're going to end up with are blue courts that better represent the people they're serving. And if Trump's nominees are any indication, who are overwhelmingly white and male in red states, you're going to end up with courts that do not represent the public they serve. But you noted a couple kind of legal consequences of this as well. I specifically liked your concern about nationwide injunctions that are going to start developing from this, and just wanted to have you explain that here.
Yeah. And one of the things I think we've already seen is, you know, there's a long-term phenomenon of forum shopping, right? People try to file lawsuits where they think they'll get a better result.
That's just good legal practice.
Right. But what we've got in a few states, in Texas and Louisiana in particular, is not just forum shopping, but judge shopping, right? That because those districts are divided into divisions and have a number of single judge divisions, I can go file a lawsuit in Amarillo, Texas, right, or Western Louisiana, and be guaranteed to get a particular judge with an extremist ideology. And so one of the things we've seen in the last couple of years is judges who are essentially kind of setting the policy for the government by making decisions, often with little justification, at the behest of a fairly extreme political group that files a lawsuit there, precisely because they know they will get a judge who's sympathetic to them. And, you know, and that's a problem. And, you know, maybe it's a problem we can solve at the appellate level, right? Although that's not worked out all that well. The Fifth Circuit is pretty stacked right now with Trump appointees as well, and not getting a lot of Biden appointees. Maybe it's a problem you can solve at the Supreme Court level. It's interesting to me that even this extremely conservative Supreme Court has ended up taking a whole bunch of Fifth Circuit cases that seem to be maybe going even too far for the Supreme Court. But the way we would ordinarily solve it, right, which is we have a balanced judiciary in any district, and so you can't know when you file a lawsuit that you will get a judge who is going to be sympathetic to your extreme ideological position, that seems to be going out the window.
Yeah, and you just hinted at it. You also end up with what you describe as ideologically pure appellate courts. So the Fifth Circuit is teeing up a lot of Supreme Court cases because the court is so heavily weighted with Republican appointed judges who all think similarly. And so you end up with more extreme decisions that are prompting the Supreme Court, hopefully fingers crossed, to rein it in. But that the whole point of having lots of judges on an appellate court is that you get lots of perspectives and experiences, and that's going by the wayside when you end up with, again, these ideologically pure courts.
I think that's right. And I also think there's another effect that's a little more subtle but is real. And both in the district courts and in the appellate courts, part of the question is, who do I draw? Who votes on it? But part of the question is, right, if they don't understand a particular legal issue, they haven't dealt with it before, who do they talk to? Right. And, you know, if you walk down the hall and you ask your judicial colleagues who might come from a variety of different backgrounds on an issue, you might get a set of views that, you know, that are disparate, right, that might challenge your initial assumptions. And as we create these enclaves of ideological purity, I think that goes away. And that's that doesn't show up, right? We don't see briefing on the issue, right? It's kind of behind the scenes, but I think it really happens, and it's a potential problem.
Yeah. So I think the note that we would certainly draw from this is it's one more reason that we need to get rid of the blue slip. We have been saying that now for over a year. It absolutely needs to happen. And the other point is, I think we need administrations who are willing to nominate folks for states of the opposite party and chance it. We need to see the system work rather than seeing White Houses that censor themselves.
Absolutely. And I think that's right. It's definitely something we need to do. It's something we need to do now and not 3 months from now, right? Because I think one plausible scenario for a year from now is that Biden is reelected, but the Senate is in Republican hands. In the past, right, that has made negotiation over judges more complicated, but it has not meant that you didn't get any judges. Right. But a Senate in Republican hands, when almost all the Republican senators are unwilling to vote for any Biden judge in any circumstance, is a recipe for gridlock. Right. And so we might have, from the next 2 years, even if Biden is reelected, no or almost no district judges appointed. And that's a problem for every district.
Which is a disaster on so many levels. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's terrifying to think about, but that is a very real possibility.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation.
But I really want to take advantage of your technology background and talk AI, which is an issue that it fascinates me and scares me in equal measure. And so I take opportunities to explore the topic as a way to address my own fear. So you have a great article that you've co-written about whether AI-generated content is protected by the First Amendment. And I have several questions about this, but I'll ask you just to kind of tee up the issue. Why is this a question at all?
Yeah. So it's this generative AI has kind of swallowed my life over the last year. I've got 5 papers.
It's swallowed society.
Yeah. 5 copyright issues. There are issues around sort of what happens when, you know, AI hallucinates and all of these other things. Right. But I think one of the issues that is a really interesting one from a First Amendment perspective is the right to free speech is a right exercised by people.
And corporations, according to the Supreme Court.
Now, I'm going to say asterisk Citizens United or corporations, but I think the theory of corporations or other institutional stuff is, right, they're just people, right? They're gatherings of people, they're groups, and groups should have speech rights too. But AI presents an interesting question because it is generating text which reads to us as grammatically correct, as making claims, but it is not thinking or arguing in the way that human beings do, right? And generative AI like ChatGPT generates text by responding to the prompt and using a database of billions of works on the internet to figure out, all right, when people use these words, what other words are most commonly used around them that would form a good sentence, right? And those sentences, right, actually work out quite well. They're right better than many students, but they're not necessarily semantically correct, right? So generative AI can and will make up falsehoods about people, right? If you ask it, what crimes has Mark Lemley committed? ChatGPT 3.5 came up with a story in which I'm guilty of misappropriation of trade secrets.
Oh my goodness.
You know, because I'm an intellectual property professor. There's an association with trade secret. Misappropriation is a crime. You can imagine how it got there, right? But what it doesn't have is a filter that says, let me go check and see if that's true or not, right? So I think you might argue, well, AI's not actually saying anything, right? Free speech is about...
It's an algorithm.
Not protecting, exactly. It's about communication, right? It's not engaged in self-expression. It doesn't have a self, right?
Not yet. We may get to the point where we're talking about robotic First Amendment rights, but we're not there yet.
Yep. No, that's right. That's right. Now, so one thing you could say is you could say, well, all right, sure, AI isn't actually speaking, but, you know, there's a company behind it and they're speaking, right? And as you noted, right, after Citizens United, right, we give corporations rights.
So like OpenAI has First Amendment rights to everything ChatGPT produces.
Yeah.
That would be that line of thinking.
Right. And the problem with that is, you know, that there's a much less direct connection between what OpenAI might want to say and what ChatGPT says than what a corporation might want to say and what its communications director says, right? So I don't think ChatGPT, I don't think OpenAI would want to be held to account for all of the things ChatGPT has ever said, including accusing me of misappropriation.
It's like Sony being responsible for everything that its Sony cameras ever recorded.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the kind of, oh, well, there's a corporation behind it argument. You know, there's something there. The corporation is, I think, often making choices, right? So ChatGPT-4, for instance, right, has a bunch of human training that goes into it that says, don't answer questions like this, don't do these things, right? We make choices as to kind of what things to say and not say at the margins as part of content moderation. But they're not really actually speaking in the sense that even a corporation would speak in the other end. Nonetheless, what Eugene Volokh and Peter Henderson and I suggest is that there might nonetheless be a reason to protect the communications of AI under the First Amendment, not because we think the speaker has an interest, but because we as listeners have an interest in reading the content and seeing the substance of those communications.
The consumer has an interest. You make the great analogy to a newspaper, right? Just like we think readers have a First Amendment right in terms of like reading the New York Times, there's a sense of the users having an interest in consuming AI-generated content.
Right. And one of the things I think notably is that the First Amendment has been held to apply to listener interests, even when things that people want to listen to, right, are not things that we independently protect. So speech by dead people, right? Dead people don't have any First Amendment rights, but I still have a right to read the words of Abraham Lincoln. Right?
I was going to say, if the government was like, we ban all Shakespeare from here until eternity, right, that would be a problem.
Right. Speech by foreign citizens, right? People who are not U.S. citizens or permanent residents don't actually have First Amendment rights. But I think we have and want to have rights to hear from people in both Israel and Palestine, for instance, about what's going on in Israel and Palestine, right? And we'd be a lot poorer if we couldn't listen to information that came from sources that didn't themselves have First Amendment rights to speak.
The point that you make on this that really brought it home to me is the hypothetical of imagine a state, and this feels very real right now. Imagine a state that calls up OpenAI and says, you need to prevent ChatGPT from expressing any output that is supportive of abortion rights or any content that is critical of a particular government official.
Right. Like that to me, you have a knee-jerk reaction to being like, wait, that is censorship. That's a problem.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And it's right. And so one way we could think about, right, the OpenAI is not as a speaker, right, but as a sort of conduit for speech and information that comes from, in this case, the AI, right? And we don't want to put the we don't want to sort of allow governments to regulate conduits, right? And you know, one thing that's worth noting is the First Amendment protects not just the freedom of speech, but also of the press, right? And, you know, one reading of that is, oh, yeah, newspapers get special protection. But I think a more plausible reading of that is, right, it's not just that we have the right to speak. It's that the right we have the right to communications technologies. In 1789, it was the printing press, right? But it's now also the television, right? And the radio and the internet and more recently, generative AI. We have the right to communicate and to have devices that allow that communication to be effectively received. And we don't want governments to be able to shut those things down and say, well, yeah, you can speak to anyone who happens to be in shouting distance, but that's it.
The last note on this that I think is really important, and this seems to be one of the more pressing AI conversations right now, is whether to require what's being called as a watermark. So that AI, you could say AI generated content is protected, but it must be identified, that consumers need to know when they're looking at something that this was AI generated, AI modified. Not unlike, you know, we're seeing political ads, and at the end of the ad has to be identified.
Right.
So talk to me about that, that you can protect AI-generated content and require that it be somehow identified as AI.
I think that's right. I think the First Amendment allows a certain amount of kind of disclosure obligation, even in circumstances where there's protected speech by corporations, for instance, by, you know, commercial speech, and even, as you note, in the context of political speech. And I think that's actually, in many cases, a really desirable thing. And one of the problems I think that we're going to face in the generative AI world is the problem of deepfakes, right? You can create a video that looks like I'm talking, but isn't in fact me saying things, right? And a mandate that says this was AI generated, slapped across the bottom of the video, I think is going to help. It's not going to solve all the problems, but it would help a lot. Same with images. It gets a little more complicated with text, right? Because I think increasingly people are not just AI generated the text or I generated the text. They're going to ask AI some questions. They're going to take some of the stuff. They're going to rewrite it. They're going to run it back into AI. They're going to get a response. You know, it'll correct some of their grammar. And so I think we might end up in a situation where we want a nuanced version that's a little more than AI generated or not AI generated.
A percentage where it says AI modified. And what is that? There's going to be some sort of legal test at some point to determine that.
Yeah. I'll tell you as a law professor, right? I encounter this in my daily life. For the last 9 months, when I give my students an exam, I give them ChatGPT's answer to the exam and say, you can do whatever you want with this. When students write a paper, I tell them, you can use AI if you want to. What I would like you to do is attach to the back of your paper what question you asked and what answer it gave. Just as I want to be able to read your sources, if you went and cited a case or a law review article, right, to know how much of this is you and how much of this is somebody else, we might want to know something similar in the AI context. And I think the First Amendment allows that sort of restriction.
Well, this is fascinating. And I would love to have another AI conversation with you going forward. I just think the law is still kind of murky and trying to figure out what the hell to do with this new technology. So
absolutely,
there's always new discussions to have.
And there's right. There's no shortage of interesting legal questions coming up right now.
Yeah. And eventually they'll get to the Supreme Court and be ready for that one. All right, Professor Lemley, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jean.
Thanks again to Professor Lemley for joining me on this episode. If you missed my earlier conversation with Russ Feingold about judicial nominations and the Supreme Court's preference for optional ethics, I encourage you to check out episode 132 wherever you are listening to this episode. And if you're enjoying the show, you can help us bring it to more listeners by recommending it to a friend and leaving us a review. And if you're traveling this holiday season, podcasts are a great way to make the time go by. So bring us with you and catch up on all our latest episodes. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.